Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Rare is the day that I start this program, a nationally syndicated program, my program, with a take on the Houston Texans. If I'm doing that, either something really good happened or something really bad happened. And you probably know what that is. Nothing good. The Texans fired Bill O'Brien back in early October. So at that time, that was the right move. When they did that, that was actually a step in the right direction. I mean, you have to stop losing before you can start winning. You have to stop going backwards before you can move forwards. So firing Bob was the right move at the right time. Unfortunately, just about every single move they've made since then has been a complete and utter disaster. A thorough and comprehensive exercise in puking all over yourself at every single chance. For instance, Cal McNair reportedly told Deshaun Watson that he could be involved in the hiring of the new GM and the new head coach. Not that he would get to make the decision, but that he would be involved in the process. The owner told him that and then completely ignored his input. So Watson reportedly had been advocating for Eric Bieniemy as a head coaching candidate. Not only did the Texans not even interview him, they were the only team with a head coaching vacancy not to interview him. And again, it's not like Bieniemy is some obscure candidate or some guy that only Deshaun Watson was interested in. No, Bieniemy has been the candidate for 2 years now. It was a shock when he didn't get a head coaching job after last season. And he's the guy that every single team wants to talk to this time around, except the Texans. The only team that didn't want to talk to him is the team that has a quarterback who's saying, that's my guy. That's the guy I want. You want my input? My input is this. Hire Eric Bieniemy. So when you see something like that, how can you not see that as the team giving Watson the biggest middle finger possible? The biggest and loudest way possible. Hey, Deshaun, tell us who you like as a head coach so we can make sure that we don't hire him. Hey, Deshaun, who do you want us to hire? We want to know so we can make sure we don't even talk to him. That's pretty much what Houston said, and that's pretty much how they handled it. And it didn't get much better with the GM search either, something else that Deshaun Watson was supposed to be involved in, because they went through this song and dance about interviewing new candidates, about going a different direction, about we're not going to be the Patriots South. Then they go out and they hire a guy that they wanted a few years back but could not get at the time. So they didn't go in a different direction. They kept doing what they've been doing. And not only was Deshaun Watson not involved in that process, but apparently he found out about that hiring on Twitter when he was on vacation. Not only did they not involve him, they didn't even tell him. He had to find out at the same time the rest of us did. Man, I've said it before, I'll say it again right now. Deshaun Watson has been an absolute blessing for the Houston Texans. He is one of the best things that has ever happened to that franchise. And pretty much from the very moment he's arrived, they have seemed bound and determined to wreck his career and break his spirit. As an example, the guy's been sacked 155 times in the last three seasons. That's more than 50 times a year. That's more than three times per game. That's some David Carr bleep right there. And sure, you can say that some of that's on him for trying to extend plays and make something happen. But know this, if I were running a team and I were lucky enough to get Deshaun Watson in the draft, I would do everything in my power to make sure that that guy was safe and that guy was healthy. And I would make damn sure that that guy was happy. So I'll tell you what I wouldn't do. I would not trade away my Hall of Fame wide receiver. I would not piss him off with the hiring process. Two things that they did do. And now the Texans are scrambling because yesterday came word, and this is rich, man, this is rich. Yesterday came word that they have requested an interview with Bieniemy. Now, if you're Eric Bieniemy and word gets back that now they want to talk to you, what are you going to do with that? How are you going to handle that? If I'm Bieniemy, I'm going to think long and hard about turning that down. Even the right to talk to them. Like normally the thing is, what's it hurting talking? In this case, a lot. And if I'm him, I'm thinking about not doing that. And not just out of pride, but you'd have every reason to turn that down out of pride. And not because it seems like they're not even serious about actually hiring you and they're only doing it to placate their star. I mean, that seems to be the case too, right? No, but I would turn it down because I've seen how that organization operates. I've seen that dysfunction firsthand if I'm Eric Bieniemy. I've seen how they came to offer me that interview, and that would tell me everything I need to know about them. It tells you that the last place you want to work, even though they have one of the best quarterbacks of a generation, that is the last place you want to work because you've seen how they handle their business. Well, one more thing. One more thing about how badly the Texans have butchered this. Houston waited until yesterday to request that interview with Bieniemy, and according to the league's anti-tampering rules, they now have to wait until Kansas City is eliminated or wins the Super Bowl. That's how dysfunctional these guys are. To quote a wise man, congratulations, you played yourself.
Congratulations, you played yourself.
Freaking bravo. Well done. Well done. You pissed off your quarterback by not interviewing one of the leading head coaching candidates when you had that chance, and then you went back to get your chance, and then you found out you have to wait a few weeks to actually do the interview. Man, you know how bad this has gotten? You know how bad this has gotten? Andre Johnson weighed in. That's right. The Texans legend tweeted the following, quote, "If I'm Deshaun Watson, I will stand my ground. The Texans organization is known for wasting players' careers. Since Jack Easterby has walked into the building, nothing good has happened in or for the organization. And for some reason, someone can't seem to see what's going on. Pathetic." Dang. Like, if you know Andre Johnson, even a little, you know that is the straightest of straight fire. This is a guy who never complains about anything. This is a guy who never really says anything about anything, no matter how bad everything is. He suffered through some absolutely brutal teams, some brutal quarterbacks, and never said a damn thing. He just showed up, balled out, and put up crazy numbers. So if that guy is saying that Deshaun Watson should stand his ground, that carries a lot of weight. And when he says, quote, "the Texans organization is known for wasting players' careers," that is the absolute brutal truth. Because they had a receiver like Johnson and nothing to show for it. Johnson also is not just speaking in theory. He's speaking in fact and in experience. He is walking proof that the Texans waste players' careers. And he's not alone. They've had J.J. Watt. They don't have a hell of a lot to show for that, do they? They had DeAndre Hopkins. They have nothing to show for that. And now Deshaun Watson. And knowing them, they'll probably have nothing to show for that too. And then Johnson turned his cannon on the mysterious Jack Easterby. Quote, "since he's walked into the building, nothing good has happened in or for the organization. And for some reason, someone can't seem to see what's going on." Hey, listen, I don't know old Jack. I have no idea what Jack actually does. But it sure doesn't seem like anything positive has happened since he arrived in Houston. And then finally, Johnson capped off that tweet with pathetic and 3 exclamation points. Again, for that guy to tweet, that's a monster statement. And even one more detail to add to this whole thing. Johnson, this is a hammer. Johnson was an advisor in the hiring process for the new GM and the head coach. So that's not just some team legend who had a few pops and then grabbed his phone and jumped on Twitter. This is coming from somebody who was an advisor in the process to hire a new GM and a head coach, and he's calling the entire situation pathetic. Or in other words, to be more succinct, DeAndre Hopkins jumped in with, quote, "when Dre speak, listen." End of quote. Well, I'd say that team should follow that advice, but I know they won't. It's been a long time since I've seen this level of dysfunction from an NFL franchise. I mean, I don't think I've seen this kind of dysfunction from an NFL franchise since, I don't know, the Jets last week, every day, today, tomorrow. That is some New York Jets bleep dysfunction right there. Congrats, Jack. You brought out a fire in Andre that I have not seen since he and my guy Cortland Finnegan gave each other the hands back in the day. Man, that is wild. You know it's bad. If I can devote an entire opening block to it, you know it's bad. Really bad. 1-800-636-8686. If you're a Texans fan and you want to get into it, you can right now. Or if you're a Texans fan, you want to get into it, save your beef for hour number three. You know it's bad if I bumped Kyrie out of the open, because that's where I would have gone. Kyrie doing Kyrie things. And then I've got thoughts on the NBA. The NBA is tightening things up. New restrictions involving COVID, and the players are not happy. And I understand why they're not happy, but at the same time, if they want to play and they want to get paid and they want there to be a season, they're going to have to comply. I mean, it's one of those lose-lose, suck-suck situations. The restrictions are pretty brutal. But then again, it seems to me that NBA season is already hanging in the balance. They have to. Oh, and look who's come around to things. Look who has come around to things finally. Giants head coach Joe Judge. Joe Judge went on WFAN. And apparently Joe Judge has finally come around to, you know what? Maybe it wasn't Philadelphia's fault that we didn't make the playoffs. Maybe it was our fault. Maybe it's not that, oh, Doug Peterson had to play Nate Sudd. Maybe the reason we're not in is not because of that, but because we lost 10 games. Right, Joe. Good answer, Joe. Way to finally come around to that, Joe. I'll get to that. That's why we're still talking about that, because Joe finally came around to it. Remember Evander Kane? Remember when I talked about Evander Kane? It's been a while, right? It's gotten worse. I've got an update, and it's not good for him. And my guy Aaron Rodgers gets a shot at his dream gig. I'll try and get that in. Chris in St. Pete, first one through. The Texans are a Brody Van Wagenen hire away from completing the Mets transformation. Damn, dude, you butchered the spelling of his name. I had to clean that up for you, Chris. One for three, C1. Quote, what a train wreck the Texans are. Signed James Harden. Yeah, Harden's handling that pretty well. Harden came out and said, you know what? We can't win here. We just can't win here. We're not competitive. Right, James? You think maybe you might have something to do with that fact? Hey, Rome, I don't have beef. I had beef burritos with queso. A lot of them before last night's game. Signed, James, hard to see my feet. Damasio in Albuquerque. Right, when we come back, I may try and get to some thoughts on James Harden. This guy's saying, you got to get me out of here. I mean, obviously, this is evidence that we're not competitive. We got hammered again. That's fine, James. You're right. You're not competitive. You do know that you're part of the reason why they're not competitive, right? The way you're handling yourself, what you've done, what you've said, the way you're playing. You know you're part of that, right? I'm not putting it all on you, but you know you're part of that. It's not just an all them thing. It's not just what they're doing to you or what's happening to you. When we come back, Ray Ratto. Clones. What do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? Not bars, not sugary snacks, not energy drinks. Man, we want beef, pure and simple. So where is the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. Shriveled, dry, tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices. They're smoked over a real wood fire, so it's tender and it's tasty. It's not rough. And why is it so good? It's because of the folks involved. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef extremely seriously. I've spoken with and know members of the family. They are legit. They're the real deal. Old Trapper is packed with protein, and it comes in four amazing flavors. So look for it in major retail stores near you. Old Trapper, what's your beef? It is Ray Ratto, and he joins us now. Ray, it has been a while since you and I last spoke. In fact, Ray, it's been way, way, way too long. Ray, how are you doing, and how is life for Raymond Ratto right now?
Well, I've been waiting in the parking lot since the last time I was on, so it's a little bit chilly.
My man.
It's fine. We have not been touched by the dreaded COVID. Being in the house every day, all day, is a pain in the keister, but you know, like I said, people have it way worse, and I've still got a job, and my wife hasn't killed me in my sleep yet, so it wins all around.
Perfect. Ray Ratto joining us. I'm going to talk to you about that job in a minute. So you're stuck in the house like a lot of people, Ray, but let me ask you this. What's it like being Ray Ratto and covering sports throughout a pandemic?
Oh, it's a gut-wrenching nightmare. I mean, oh, you're just talking, oh, being Ray Ratto is a gut-wrenching nightmare. covering sports,
right.
I got used to it pretty quickly. Everybody, you know, in the business was worried that there wouldn't be anything to write about or talk about when there were no games. And it turns out that the business of sports creates more conversation than the sports themselves. So I never felt like we were running dry. We were running weird, and I didn't know how long the weird would last, but we're still getting weird today. So I think we basically have found a well that continues to bubble up weird. And so we get kissed on the forehead every morning because there's always something goofy to talk about.
And as I've always mentioned, Ray, weird is good in almost every case. Now, Ray, one of the things that I've always loved about you, in addition to your sweaters and the fact that you were the only panelist on our TV show who would ever take a drink of water during the segment itself, was the fact that you see through some of the BS surrounding sports, the stuff that some people get way too wrapped up in. How would you describe then your relationship with sports in general?
I've worked very hard to compartmentalize what I see from what I know. I mean, the games are still fun to watch, you know, athletic achievement, athletic goofiness. I mean, that's still fun, but I've had to put it sort of in a different place than it used to be because there are way more important things going on this year more than any other. And I've found that the fascinating thing is how sports has reacted to that. And largely, it's reacted poorly because I think most people in sports have been worried way too much about the schedule and not nearly enough about the health and safety of the people it employs or gathers as an audience. I mean, the NFL is proud of the fact that it played all 256 games. And I'm not sure that's something you should be proud of because that means you're putting, you know, the events ahead of the people. And I think one of the things, I mean, we saw it in baseball. We surely saw it in college football. We're seeing it to a certain extent in college basketball. There's a point at which the games are less important than they used to be, not because they're trivial, but because they're getting in the way of helping get rid of the virus. We all thought that, you know, the distraction would be helpful. But what we're finding out when you look at the ratings on all sports is that fewer people are going for the distraction. I mean, the national championship game Monday night had the lowest rating ever. The six playoff games over the weekend, the four that could be compared, were down like 25%. I think there's a general mood, at least among sports fans, that they wouldn't believe this before, but I think in some ways they can take it or leave it. And I think sports has been slow to sort of understand that. You know, they're providing a service, but it's not a vital service. It's we don't need sports. Sports needs us.
We're talking to Ray Ratto. You know, it's really interesting, Ray, when you lay it out like that, because, and I agree, there is certainly something to that, and we make our business talking about sports, covering sports, and in fact, now you're writing for Defector.com. For those who are late to the party, what is Defector, and what is it about that opportunity that appealed to you so much?
It's basically, I mean, this may not explain it very well, but it's the old Deadspin, and what it was a blog site. It was a website with sports and other things. And the people who were working there full time ran afoul of their new bosses who wanted to get rid of all the other things and just have people write about sports and try to monetize it better, even though it was making money at the time. And so the people who were there just up and quit. They just said, we're not working under those conditions because we're succeeding doing what we're doing. And most of them went, you know, they were unemployed for a while. They did the brave thing of basically going fingers up to the boss. And I was doing some freelancing for them at the time, so I really wasn't part of that. You know, I was just somebody they'd asked to do something here and there. So when they gathered together again to say, let's do this, you know, the same way, only we'll be the bosses, they were gracious enough to ask me if I'd be part of that, and I jumped at it. It was a chance to write again. It was a chance to write the way I want to write, you know, to look at the games and the business the way I want to. And it's been a delight. And I usually don't say that about work.
I was going to say, Ray, I've never heard you describe anything as a delight.
Well, I'm having fun. I expect that in about 6 months it's going to become a nightmare. But, you know, so far they haven't figured out how to do it yet.
Right. That's great. Ray Ratto is joining us. Ray, one of the pieces you have up right now is on Tom Flores, who's a finalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame for the third time. First off, why do you think that he has not gotten into the Hall in the past? And does this campaign behind him this year feel different this time around?
I think the fact that he's the coaching finalist is different, and the only coaching finalist. I think it's resonating more that he was the first Hispanic coach. And I think, you know, in some ways, you know, at least the Pro Football Hall of Fame is understanding that there are things other than what you see in Pro Football Reference. I think the reason why he hasn't gotten in before that is because his win-loss record is relatively ordinary for a Hall of Fame candidate. He doesn't have I think it's like 526, which is lower than Don Coryell's, and Don Coryell has missed six times. So I think what they've sort of taken into account is the fact that he did win two Super Bowls and won them while working for Al Davis, which is its own sort of suicide pact. And I think the fact that, you know, he was the first, you know, Hispanic coach is resonating with some voters. I think he'll get in this time because there really is no sort of impediment to that before, because he's only been a finalist, like I said, twice before, and last year was the year that they threw in about 30 guys. And so it was a crowded field, and it's still a crowded field, but he's the guy who got to the finals this time. And the guy who gets to the finals has got a 50-50 shot of getting in, which is better than he's ever had before.
Ray Ratto is a columnist for Defector.com. He is an icon. He is a good friend of the program. Ray, you've also got a great piece up on the passing of Tommy Lasorda and the last of the baseball managers who were truly the center of attention. What was Tommy like to cover back in the day?
He was basically everything that everybody said. He was funny. He was crude. He was a bully. He was funny. He was a good baseball man, and he benefited from being in the right town at the right time. I don't know that Tommy Lasorda could have or would have been near as successful, say, if he was in Cincinnati, where the audience is different and the players were different. But in Los Angeles, you could be a star, and he knew how to be a star. I mean, he had his dark side like a lot of people of that era did, but for the most part, he knew how to be a good cartoon character, you know. And I think, you know, in Los Angeles in the 70s, that was kind of helpful for baseball, because baseball was and is becoming again a very gray game. And so he was sort of the antidote to that. And he didn't mind playing the villain. And that helped too. So he was basically a very good baseball man, but he was a great actor.
And a great character, and he loved being who he was, and that's always my favorite thing about people. I love people who love being who they are. He loved being Tommy Lasorda. Now, Ray, not that long ago, Brian Curtis wrote a profile on you trying to get to the bottom of who you are, and there are some amazing details for this piece. As an example, going back to the day, Nick Peters gave you some advice, quote, never show fear. For those who do not know, who was Nick Peters, and then what did that advice mean to you?
Nick Peters was a longtime beat writer in the Bay Area. He covered the Giants primarily, but he also was sort of he was the sports editor at the newspaper in Berkeley when it had one. And he was a guy who had seen everything and done everything. And so when I was starting out, starting to cover baseball on site, you know, I went over to him. I said, I've got to sit down with Frank Robinson. What do I need to know? And what he said was, don't show fear, because they'll kill you, and they won't hide the evidence. They'll just destroy you and they'll move on. So I went in, did the interview. And after about two questions, when he was profoundly uncooperative, I just got up and said, I could get this at home. I don't need this. I'm going to go And so I got up to leave, and he said, where are you going? I said, you know, I'm not going to go through grief to get one-word answers. And he said, sit down. And we ended up talking for 45 minutes. And the only reason why that happened was because Nick Peters told me not to back down. You know, you don't have to be rude, but you don't have to subject yourself to somebody else's rudeness. And it was advice that really served me in good stead for a long time. I'm glad you brought the question up, because Nick Peters is very much a Bay Area icon.
Ray Ratto joining us. So, Ray, did that same approach work with Barry Bonds? What was it like to cover Barry?
I never got the same response, but Bonds also didn't, you know, try to bully me. And I also did the one thing that I think was the best thing to do with recalcitrant athletes is only go up to them when you need them and don't hang around their locker hoping they'll pass by. Just operate on your day. If you don't have to talk to them, don't talk to them. And, you know, I don't know that, you know, I had any kind of relationship with him, but it was not a hostile. But whatever relationship I had, it wasn't hostile. It was just, okay, what do you want? And then I'd ask, I'd get my answer, and I'd leave. I mean, you sort of have to read the personality as best you can. And sports writers, by and large, aren't good at that. But there are some relative guidelines. You know, if a guy doesn't want to talk and you don't have to talk to them, don't talk to them. You know, it's not like you're going to miss anything and you're going to get your story done anyway. So, you know, don't get your feelings hurt that they don't care about you, because they don't care about anybody.
It seems pretty logical. So, Ray, you go way back in this business and you know how much this business has changed over the years. And not a lot of people have been able to stay around the way you have and remain relevant to maintain a meaningful voice. You've done that. How have you been able to do that?
Largely luck. I mean, I'll be honest with you. When I got laid off at NBC at the end of 2018, I sort of thought that was it. But, you know, Matt Nahigian at the radio station, KGMZ, reached out to me. And then Barry Pacheski at Defector reached out to me, too. So, you know, there are a lot of people who have sort of, you know, run the race. And then when it ended, there was no second act. I got lucky twice. And that's really all this is, because the way media jobs are shrinking and the way that, you know, fewer and fewer independent outlets are out there for people to go after, to get a couple of them, you know, I rolled a 7. That's basically it, because people as good as me and better than me never did get back in, and I always remember that.
He is Ray Ratto. He is an icon. He is the co-host of Damon Ratto and Kolsky. He was a columnist, or is, for Defector.com. He was a panelist on our daily TV show back in the day, which was an absolute blast. He is a legend. Raymond, it's so good to have your voice. We should have done this so much sooner. I'm glad we came together. We will do it again much sooner than that. And it's so great to have you back, Ray.
So tomorrow at 9:30? Yeah?
Perfect. Perfect.
Great.
You got it. Every day at 9:30, Ray. All right?
Sounds good.
See you tomorrow, 24 hours from now. Ray Ratto. So we're 72 hours out from the divisional round of the NFL playoffs. 72 hours from football's Elite Eight battling to make it into football's Final Four. And yet here I am, 72 hours out from that. And I'm going to spend some precious airtime, precious real estate, talking about the New York Giants. Why is that? Believe me, I don't want to, but I have to. Because yesterday, New York Giants head coach Joe Judge finally pulled himself up a chair at the accountability table. He ordered a main course of common sense, and then slugged a giant glass of ice-cold reality. Better late than never, Joseph, I guess. Let's go back 10 days. You'll remember then-Eagles coach. That's how long ago that was. Then-Eagles coach Doug Peterson putting in third-stringer Nate Sudfeld late in a close game against the Washington football team with all sorts of playoff implications on the line. Not for Philly, mind you, but for the Giants and the WFT. If the Giants win that game, or I should say if the Eagles win that game, the Giants are dancing in the first round as divisional winners. But the Eagles did not win that game, in large part because Dougie P waved the white flag, allegedly, and ran Sudfeld in. You know, in a one-score game, in a close game. So, why? Who cares? Ancient history, 10 days ago. Better draft pick, hates the Giants, really wants to work in Sudfeld. I don't know, and I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn because it's ancient history. And so is Doug Peterson, by the way. But the morning after that game, when the Giants went from potential division winners to cleaning out their lockers, head coach Joe Judge went with an all-time verbal subtweet. He didn't name names, but he didn't have to. Everybody knew this soapboxing was about Dougie Peterson and the Eagles.
To look at a group of grown men who I asked to give me effort on a day-in, day-out basis and to empty the tank, and then I can look them in the eye and assure them that I'm always going to do everything I can to put them at a competitive advantage and play them in a position of strength. To me, you don't ever want to disrespect those players and their effort and disrespect the game. The sacrifices that they made to come into work every day and test before coming in, to sit in meetings spaced out, to wear masks, to have shields over those masks, to go through extensive protocols, to travel in unconventional ways, to get text messages at 6:30 in the morning telling practice is going to be canceled. We have to do a virtual day, okay? To tell them, please don't have your family over for Thanksgiving. Please avoid Christmas gatherings. We know it's your wife's birthday. Let's make sure we put that one off to the off season. There's a number of sacrifices been made by all the players and coaches in this league. There's a number of sacrifices that come along as well with the family members, the people connected to them. To disrespect the effort that everyone put forward to make this season a success for the National Football League, to disrespect the game by going out there and not competing for 60 minutes and doing everything you can to help those players win, we will never do that as long as I'm the head coach of the New York Giants.
You mean do those things that every other team and every other player had to do around the league throughout the year? Blah, 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 blah. How many times are we going to hear this? That rant is littered with the same old word salad that Judge is consistently vomiting up. Him rambling on about the sacrifices everybody had to make and their families had to make for an NFL season to become a reality. How hard these guys all work. How much it all means to them. Never mind that pretty much everybody in the league works really hard and really cares and had to make tremendous sacrifices. I mean, doing all that does not make you unique or better than anybody else. Bad enough to keep playing that broken record, but even worse, because he didn't address the only thing that really did matter, the fact that his try-hard crew was 6-10. He didn't own that fact. That if you're 6-10 in the worst division ever, that's pretty much the only thing that really does matter in a business like that. And no one gives a damn about anything else, nor should they. He didn't mention that they were playing some of their worst football when it mattered most. He didn't mention that they lost 3 of their last 4 with the division hanging in the balance. And that they didn't have anybody to blame but themselves. He didn't get to any of that. Just that, well, you know, our guys work really, really hard, and we really, really care, and it's too bad the other guy doesn't, or we wouldn't be in this position, when in fact you would be. You would be, regardless of what the Eagles did or did not do, because you are what your record says you are, and your record says you're 6-10. And for some reason, Judge just could not get his head wrapped around the most obvious thing ever. And the only reason that I'm still talking about that now, with the divisional playoffs coming up, is because Judge was asked about it yet again. Except this time, he finally started to get it. This is what he had to say yesterday on Boomer and Geo.
Look, that's our fault. Point blank. We have to do better. 6-10 is not a playoff team. That's reality. That's what it is. You don't deserve to be in the playoffs with that. And our guys know that. They understand that. Our guys are very, you know, realistic at how they look at things. We're very honest and transparent with our team in all moments. We're not trying to sit back and trying to make some kind of excuse, or we're not sitting back trying to paint some picture someone else owes us anything. They don't.
It's a good take, Joe. It's a really good take. I thought so when I said the exact same thing 9 days ago on this radio program. While you were on a Zoom soapbox talking about how the Eagles disrespected the game. When really what you were trying to say is the Eagles disrespected you. And blew any chance of you backdooring your way in. Anyway, welcome to the party, pal.
Welcome to the party, pal.
The reality party, pal. The ownership party, pal. The accountability party, pal. the party where a 6-10 head coach finally admits that his 6-10 team got exactly what it deserved. A 6-10 team does not deserve to be in the postseason and was owed nothing by anyone. Now, are all of your players who were live tweeting that Eagles WFT game 10 days ago going to own it as well? Because that also was a bad look. Bunch of 6-10 players hammering out entitled hate tweets as they watch their playoff hopes circle the drain, lacking any kind of accountability or self-awareness. You know, the self-awareness that comes along with losing 10 games and playing in the worst division ever. Besides, you want to get right down to it, Joe? Nobody's mad outside your locker room that the Giants missed the postseason. Because instead, what we all received was a nice dose of Taylor Heinicke. Taylor Heinicke took us on this amazing 60-minute ride where it looked for a moment that he might actually slay the GOAT himself. Crazy, right? Absolutely crazy that that anonymous player that before that game so many people had never even heard of was standing in and trading haymakers with the GOAT. Crazy when you think that he was a St. Louis Battlehawks quarterback less than even 1 year ago. Am I right, James Kelly?
St. Louis Battlehawks quarterback.
I mean, I'm talking about the St. Louis Battlehawks. It's an amazing name for a team. Am I right, James Kelly?
St. Louis Battlehawks.
Hey, flight deck, what job did Taylor Heinicke hold before the job he currently holds with the Washington football team?
St. Louis Battlehawks quarterback.
Hey, Deck, when The Rock brings back the XFL, which team are you most looking forward to watching?
St. Louis Battlehawks.
Hey, you want to hear something amazing? Check this out. Discover matches all the cash back that you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year automatically, with no limit on how much you can earn. I mean, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing because of all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of the places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. Discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report. Limitations do apply. My guest is Sean Alexander. Sean, it's been a minute or two since you and I have caught up. How are you doing? How is your life? What's going on, Sean?
Man, it is so good to see you, man. This is exciting to be a part of this. You know, life is good in the midst of this craziness, but it's good, man. I can't complain. Family's healthy and getting bigger and you know, being a part of the FedEx Air and Ground Players of the Year award is a lot of fun. That's what I'm doing now. So it's just going good. How are you doing?
Sean, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. My family's great. My family's not getting bigger, but my family is great. And I'm going to talk to you about FedEx in a minute. But when you mentioned your family's getting bigger, how much bigger? How is your family?
Yeah, so we just found out that we are pregnant with baby number 12.
Wow.
And so it's congrats. Amazing. Yeah.
Congratulations.
All
that is amazing.
All of ours, no twins, a lot of hard work.
No doubt, Sean. Congratulations. That's great. So let me go back to the very beginning. Like, people know your story, I'm sure, but I'm not sure that everybody knows what that journey really involved. For instance, it's not like you were a star from day one. That's not how that went. For example, when you were playing JV football, you did so as a sophomore. So what were you like as a running back at that point in time?
You know what? From the very beginning, I was always one of those guys that I wanted to score touchdowns. I wanted to make the play, make the big special moment. And so, we had some really good running backs at my high school. And one of them ended up playing pro baseball for the Reds. And he got hurt. They put me in the game to run the option, and they pitched it to me, and I took it down the sideline. They were like, wait, hold on a second. So I became in the part of the rotation, and it's just been on from there. And then same thing in Bama, you know, I was behind the SEC first team and SEC second team. So I was a third stringer my freshman year, and they threw me in a game against LSU, and 20 carries, 291 yards later, four touchdowns. I became part of the Bama rotation of great running backs, and then got to Seattle and Ricky Waters was there. So I'm just sitting on the bench the whole first year, and Ricky gets hurt. They put me in the game, and I think it was like 170 yards and a touchdown, and then the next one's 150 and two more touchdowns. They're like, we need to play you. And so that's always been my story is eventually I'm going to get the time and just go take it over. And so that's how my career's been.
That's great the way you laid that out. Sean Alexander is joining us. That's the way it's always been, high school, college, even the pros. And then after you got that shot in the NFL, the following season, you got your chance. You rushed for more than 1,300 yards. So what was it like to break out that way and show everybody yet again, I can do special things, I just need the opportunity?
Yeah, you know what? I think that's the goal. The goal is always for you to prepare for your moment. And then when it's your turn, you take the shot, you make the big play, you hit the home run. Like, that's what you want. Like, you always are, you should always be building yourself up for that moment where you get to go be the one that that gets to write the story. And, you know, and so when everybody does it, whenever you see somebody do it, you kind of smile because you either want to eventually one day be that guy, or you want to smile and say, yeah, I remember when I got to do that before. But that's always part of the life journey.
Sean Alexander is joining us. You know, you mentioned when you started early on, you wanted to be that guy. You just wanted to get the ball. You wanted to score touchdowns. Sean, there was that game in 2002 against the Vikings where you scored five touchdowns in one half. When you think back, what do you remember most about that game?
You know, John Randall was the new defensive tackle that we picked up, and he played all those years with the Vikings. And he was just saying the whole week, man, Sean, don't let us lose this game. We got to win this game. And I knew it was just big to him. And so I kind of came to the game with a chip on my shoulder. And then plus one of my buddies from high school was Randy Moss, and he was the star on their team. And so I always kind of put myself in the thought process of go be greater than their running back, go be greater than their star. And then, and so I just wanted to, I studied that week well. And I knew there were some plays that really fit what I wanted to do. And it was just a great game plan. And the ball just bounced the right way a lot. And so I had them five touchdowns in the first half. It was crazy and a lot of fun. So I remember Randall coming up to me and being like, man, do it again. And I scored the third touchdown. He's like, what is going on? I'm like, I'll be back. I'm in a groove now, you know. So that was just a fun night.
He was a blast. John Randall was such a great player, and what a huge personality. I mean, Sean, it's one thing to be like that bell cow back, but you had a five-year stretch where you had, check these numbers, 309 carries, 295 carries, 326, 353, and then 370 carries. Like, running backs talk about what a 300-carry season does to them, the toll that it takes on them, and you did that for five straight years. How did you go about taking care of your body and making sure that you could recover and play at such a high level?
Yeah, you know, you do have to take care of your body. So, like, the very basic, you know, masseuses and chiropractors, none of that made any sense to me. Ricky Waters was like, no, you need this. And so he taught me how to be a pro and studying the game and letting yourself loose on game day, but then how to take care of your body. So chiropractors, masseuses, and sauna treatments and things like that. And I remember learning what an infrared sauna was, which is like heating your body. It's the infrared, so it's heating your body from the inside so the blood and the bones can heal faster, where everybody used to, this is a normal sauna with the hot rocks, and that's heating from the outside in, which is really about sweating and so instead of healing. And so the science and technology for people today in today's game is so much better than ever before, because they're learning how to heal their body and not just protect their body, which is, that's what muscles do. Muscles, you build it to protect your bone, where now they're learning how to heal the body as it's going. So the guys today, though they have the ability, because they're bigger and stronger, to have bigger hits and bigger collisions, but they also know how to get healthier faster. And you have to be very intentional with all that as you're churning and training and preparing for every year and every game.
Sean Alexander is joining us. It's a fascinating response, but it's not just the physical. Like, you were very progressive in your thought and probably ahead of your time. But Sean, when I think about the year 2005, you put up nearly 1,900 rushing yards, 27 touchdowns. You were named league MVP, and in part because of what you just said, you were taking care of your body. However, you spent a lot of time working on the mental and spiritual aspects of your play and your game and yourself personally. What was that about? Like, what was your process for building yourself up mentally and spiritually?
You know, at the end of the day, like, I just felt like just mentally there's this place where you can say, like, hey, this is who God's created me to be. How can I be the best this all the time? And so it's relationships with people, relationships with your line, relationship with your coach, how you're thinking about it, and it expands back out to the bigger pictures of life. And so also playing a violent sport like football, where it's a great sport, it's a team sport, but then also even spiritually, are you willing to take yourself to someplace greater for the greater cause? And so I just always felt like the better I played, the more of a platform I could have to represent Jesus, to represent the love of God, the love of people and family. Those are his perfect plans. That's his perfect team, would be a family. And so that's why I played for. I love the idea of family and team. And I got a lot of that from just learning about Jesus and how faith does that. And so it was just an amazing time. And I feel like my 05 season, I was at very good, healthy places mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, as well as physically.
Sean Alexander is joining us. Sean, really quickly, before I ask you about FedEx, I want to ask you about your other family, the Alabama family. You're a proud Alabama alum. What did you think as you watched Najee Harris and the Crimson Tide win yet another national title?
Yeah, I was so proud of this team. You know, every team is different. I think people used to seeing the name Alabama and they forget that, you know, Najee Harris, though he was a five-star, had to learn how to play college football at a high level greatly and consistently. And so what he was his freshman and sophomore year compared to his junior year was miles. And it's almost country miles away from how he played his senior year compared to his sophomore year. So I'm just proud of his growth as a football player, his growth on and off the field. And I was just proud. Same thing with Mac Jones. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he comes in with Tua and the Wonder Triplets, the receivers that we just loved. And Mac was just a good player, but always in his head, always beating his own self up, wanting to be great, but not knowing how to get there. And to watch him get to his this year and play so well and be under control and poise, that is the maturation process that you give Coach Saban credit to and the whole Bama family. They've done that well for centuries now, but really these last couple of decades have been just amazing about how to get guys to go play at a high level consistently.
Sean, you're working with FedEx Air and Ground Players for their Player of the Year awards, and I'm glad you are because it brought you and I back together so we can get caught up. What about the work you're doing with them? What are you doing exactly, and how can the fans get involved?
So the FedEx Air and Ground NFL Player of the Year Award, I won it in 05 when I won the MVP that great year you were talking about. And we want to get fans to get out and vote, NFL.com/FedEx, then get on Twitter at NFL. We want fans to get involved because it is a great award highlighting the best player from the air, quarterback, and the best player from the ground, the running back. But it's more than just an award. The FedEx has partnered with Direct Relief, and Direct Relief is a program that they have these great emergency medical care backpacks that are helping about 500 people per bag. And so all of that is about us doing what the FedEx plan is. The FedEx Care Plan is 50 by 50, helping 50 million people by their 50th year, which is 2023. That's the big picture. But we get to squeeze a little bit of football involved with by having the best quarterback and the best running back get sponsored, win the award, and then we give $20,000 per award to the cities to go and help more people, because this is really about more than just an award. It's about helping people. And so they've been doing this for about since 2003, the FedEx Award and their partnership with Direct Relief. And now we get to be a part of impacting more than just having a good time, but impacting families. So it's 50 by 50, 50 million people by 2023. And it's just exciting. It's exciting to be a part of something. So we want fans to get out and vote, be a part of it. Voting now starts now, and it closes February 2nd at 3 p.m.
Let's go to the up and coming shiny metropolis that is Buffalo. Rick, what's going on, brother?
Forget the models in the sushi gym. Saturday's win over the Colts was so big, I went straight for the strippers and blow. It was the kind of win that can propel a team in a city to its first ever Super Bowl title. And now that the weight of a 25-year playoff winless streak is gone, Josh Allen and the boys are ready to burn this mother down. And I'm especially excited for the young Bills Mafia who are experiencing the madness for the very first time. There was nothing better than putting my 4-year-old son and his little buddy through a couple tables, then teaching them how to funnel beers afterwards. And we'll be at the stadium again Saturday night. And if we should happen upon any Ravens fans, the young Bucks will get their first lesson in kicking some ass. And along those same lines, Jim, I heard that clown Matt Van was in here running his mouth about wanting to fight me. Not sure if that idiot knows, but I got two hobbies in life, calling this show and punching people in the face. So challenge accepted. And forget about Fight Island, Jim. Let's just make it happen in your studio. And after I take care of Matt, I'll put the whole Hawk vs. Ritt thing to bed when I beat the holy hell out of both of them. But don't worry, I promise to leave little Elvie alone because I don't pick on pathetic kids. Or John Harbaugh being almost as big of a diaper bitch as Mike and Indy. Or Donald Trump being almost as big of a bunker bitch as Mike and Indy. Or Saturday night being all right for fighting. Bills 34, Ravens 10. To quote that fat-ass Ritt, mark it down. Thanks for the vine, Jim. Who loves you, baby?
Absolutely amazing. Rakim Rick in Buffalo. To quote that fat-ass Ritt, mark it down.
Mark it down.
Ritt, he didn't say badass. He said fat-ass.
Fat.
And he said he'd whip your ass. And Hawk. But he would not pick on Alvy because I don't pick on pathetic kids. I've got two hobbies, Jim. Calling the show and punching people in the face. Foye Aluakon is my guest. Foye, great to have you on the show. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, good. So you wrapped up your third NFL season. Let me start right there. When you look back on the season you just had, what was it like for you personally?
It was good. I mean, a lot of it was just proving to myself that I could become like an established player in the league. So, you know, going through that off season, coming into the season, it was a lot of motivation, like self-motivation, trying to get myself right for the year.
All right, so what about that? I mean, that was your first season as a full-time starter, and as you just said, you wanted to prove to everybody, look, I belong here, I earned this right, and then you go out and you lead the team in tackles. How much pride then is there in proving that if you got that opportunity, you could deliver at the highest level the way you did?
Yeah, it's just something I've always kind of been accustomed to, regardless of what level it's been. So whether it's been, you know, college coming in, playing as a freshman, and then eventually moving to safety, eventually moving to linebacker, whatever opportunity I got, you know, I wanted to relish in it. And then, you know, I got to the league, I was more of a special teams player, and then Debo got hurt my rookie year. I got to play a lot more, and then I kind of just wanted to prove the coaches they're making the right decision for playing me, and then, you know, kind of using that to propel myself into this third year, using that same confidence I got from my rookie and second year. Whenever I got my opportunity, I felt like I did well.
Foye Aluakon is joining us. You mentioned the position changes. I want to talk to you about that in a minute. But I did read off some of the stats at the top of the interview. From where I'm sitting, now I don't have a vote, but from where I'm sitting, they feel like Pro Bowl stats, and yet you weren't even on the initial Pro Bowl ballot, as in your name was not even an option for people to choose when they voted. I know you're not in it for personal awards, but did that feel personal? Like, how much did that bother you? Did you feel disrespected by that?
Yeah, like, at the beginning, like, when I first got left off of it, I didn't really think much of it. I just actually woke up from a nap when I got on the initial ballot. But it's kind of like a respect thing because, you know, you play, at least for this year, I played to kind of earn my respect out there. And then when I wasn't really put on the ballot, but I knew of guys that were there, I feel like maybe weren't playing as well at that time, it was kind of just odd that I wouldn't be on the ballot. So definitely a little bit more motivation going into the rest of the year there. But, you know, I don't really play for Pro Bowl recognition. I play to win games, but definitely wanted my respect too.
All right, so they eventually did add you to the ballot. So what would it mean to you to receive a Pro Bowl nod at some point? If not now, but at some point, what would that mean?
I mean, that would be great. It just means that my little recognition from all the hard work that I put in around the league. But as I said, I don't really play for, you know, that Pro Bowl recognition. I know it is a popularity contest, and me coming from a small school, kind of unheard of for folks in my career, I know it's going to be hard for me to get into the Pro Bowl. But, you know, with more success, with more good plays I put out there, that would be more of a possibility.
So let's talk about that small school for a minute. During your first two seasons in the NFL, when a bye week came around, you would go back to Yale and you'd get some work in with your old position coach. A lot of guys in that situation take that bye week and they take a vacation. You were actually doing work. Why was that? And what did you take away from those sessions?
I just know that a lot of it is kind of routine for your body. So if you take a week off completely like that, your body's going to relax. And I know how long of a season it is and not want any like minor injuries from you not being in shape or something. So really, I went up to Yale. I did relax in part of the bye week, but I did go up to Yale. I did get my workouts in up there just because I knew once we got back, we're back to the normal schedule. So it wasn't much to really think about. I feel like it was kind of normal for me. And now I just got to see my old coaches and old teammates. So it was a win-win on both those parts.
That, it sounds uncommon to me. That does not seem normal generally, but I could see where it would be normal for you. You mentioned the position changes. Like when you started out, you were a cornerback at Yale, then you moved to safety, then you moved to linebacker. What were those transitions like, and then how comfortable are you at linebacker now?
Yeah, the transitions kind of were seamless. I mean, I think they recruited me to move me to safety, but I played corner my whole life in high school. So I think an injury or two happened my freshman year there, and I got to stay at corner. And then my sophomore year, they eventually moved me to safety. And, you know, kind of just learning the game from a different viewpoint back there. And eventually I got moved into like this hybrid safety linebacker type that kind of did everything on the field. And I think that really helped me, getting me film out there, seeing how versatile I was for the NFL. So my athleticism could carry over. And then when I got to the NFL, linebacker's a whole different game. I had to see, you know, pullers, which I struggled with, you know, in training camp and stuff. But as it went on, as I studied more film of myself and other linebackers, I became more comfortable back there for sure. And then this year, I kind of went back to playing all over the field again. So it's really, I have a lot of versatility. However the coach wants to use me, I feel like I can be capable football player, any type of position they want.
You've proven that. Atlanta Falcons linebacker Foye Oluokun is joining us now. You mentioned the coaching staff at Yale. Let me ask you about Tony Reno. Tony Reno said this of you, and I quote, "He's so driven to be elite and to do it for everybody else around him, and that's a big part of who we've been since I've known him. He's the same guy right now as he was then," end quote. So I'm always curious about what makes guys go, what makes guys tick, like that drive to be great, that drive to be elite. Where did that come from?
I feel like it's just how I was raised. My parents always wanted me to be the best at whatever I was doing. So with them, they wanted me to be the best student. You know, they did education very, very hard. So, but anything my dad or mom put me at, they wanted the best for me in that, you know, aspect. So when I chose to go to sports as a profession, they wanted me to be the best, you know, professional athlete I could be. And I'm just always driven that I'm a really competitive person. I don't like anybody to say that they're better than me at something. So even though I might acknowledge somebody is, you know, better than me at first, I'm definitely striving to be better than them. That's just the competitor in me. So every time I watch film in the off season or in the season, if I see somebody, you know, who has that recognition, who has, you know, that over me, I'm going to say, all right, what can I do? Be as good as him or better than him. And I feel like that kind of always drives me, just that competitive spirit in me.
You know, there's so much that goes into doing the job that you do, right? And there's so many things that you can control, and there are things you can't control. You can control the way you react to things, the way you work, the way you prepare, your technique, things like that. But then there's the business of the business. As an example, the season did not get off to the best start, and it led to Dan Quinn being fired as head coach. What was that experience like for you personally?
It's the first time I've ever had a coach, you know, that I came in with, I didn't finish with. So it's different. I mean, that's just the NFL. But, you know, high school, I had the same coach the whole time. College, same coach the whole time. So it was just different because I like to thrive. I like to fight for my coach. And then, you know, he's not there no more. Fortunately, I had another coach that I'd grown with through the years, Ra, which is another great guy. And so we were fighting for him. But I kind of felt like me personally, I wanted to make sure that, you know, he brought me to the organization. He brought me in the NFL. I wanted to prove that he made the right decision. So I always fight for him regardless.
What about Raheem Morris? You just mentioned him. What do you make of the job that he did as interim head coach?
Yeah, good. When we start off 0-5, I feel like a lot of teams cave it in, you know, pack it in. We fight every week, and I know we had some bad losses, unfortunate losses throughout the season, but we were there fighting every week, week in, week out for a W. So I like the job he did, motivated us, and got the best out of it.
So finally, I'm curious, like, how are you approaching your time now that the season is over for you and your team? Do you try to unplug completely from the game? Are you watching playoff games? How are you approaching it?
Yeah, I took a week off, and I'm feeling like a bum already, so I feel like working out again. But I take usually like a month off, try to let my body heal, month and a half off, and I'll start slowly working out again, running again. Usually start playing basketball, but right now I'm letting my body heal a little bit more this offseason. But, yeah, within that month and a half, I'll start slowly working out again, and then by 2 months I'm lifting heavy again, getting my feet back under me and everything, and back at it, trying to get I'm a better football player the rest of the offseason.
Foye, when you say you take a week off, I'm curious, for you, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean you can eat? I mean, are you, like, not picking up a single weight, not doing any cardio? Are you eating whatever you want, whenever you want? Like, what does a week off mean?
So I thought I was going to do that. So I did, I bought a case of soda. I was a soda addict when I was little. So I bought a case of soda. I popped my first Sprite right after the season, and it hit really hard. Like, I love Sprite. But then, like, I just felt unhealthy. I couldn't go about it how I wanted to. So I started eating a little bit healthier the second half of the week. But no, I didn't pick up a weight. I didn't run or nothing. I was watching games this weekend. I got remotivated to do something because I just hate when I feel like people are getting better than me. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I know I have to stay off my legs because I just played a full season. But I'm going to find a way to get active again.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a matter of being lazy or not motivated. That's like rest, recovery, that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, important,
like,
to recover, for sure.
Yeah, like, when was the last time you had a soda? If that Sprite was the first can you'd have in a long time, when was the last time you had soda?
Last offseason, the last time I had soda, last year.
Wow, and then finally, nutrition. Like, generally, how do you eat? What's your approach to nutrition?
I definitely try to keep it healthy, but, you know, stuff that I like. So I eat a lot of lean meats and vegetables, and then my carbs will depend on the day I have coming up. So, if I have a heavy running day or something I'm about to do, I'll eat more carbs. I'm not really running. Like right now, I'm probably not eating that many carbs. I don't need that energy that's not going to get burned. It'll turn into, you know, fats or whatever that I don't need.
Obviously, you got a plan. You're working that plan. Body as temple. Yeah. He was the 200th pick in the 2018th draft overall. He was an all-Ivy League selection at Yale. Foye Oluokun joining us. Foye, great job, man. Good to talk to you. Great to have you on the show. Let's be sure we do it again next season.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Good night!